in the Duterte election when he won. So he won the presidential election in part because there were so many candidates running, in part because he is charismatic and these things appealed, but also in part because there were so many candidates running and a number of candidates who were more committed to liberal democracy didn't drop out of the race and back one person, which was, and so Duterte won and he became president in 2016.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Amanda Yun, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Chris Park. Rodrigo Duterte has brought the world's attention to the Philippines with his brash, populist rhetoric and tough-on-crime policies. In this episode, we look at the president's rise to power, his major foreign and domestic policies, and to what extent he will be involved in Filipino politics going forward. We also discuss the upcoming election in the Philippines and the major candidates and how their policies and personalities will shape the future of the country. Joining us to answer these questions is Joshua Kurtzlancic.
Joshua Kurtzlancic is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the author of a forthcoming book on China's information and influence activities. Kurtzlancic was previously a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he studied Southeast Asian politics and economics. He is currently focused on China's relations with Southeast Asia and China's approach to soft and hard power. He is also working on issues related to the rise of global populism, populism in Asia, and the impact of COVID-19 on illiberal populism and political freedom.
Thank you so much for joining us on today's podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So to start off with, can you briefly explain to our listeners the background of Rodrigo Duterte? Where is he originally from and how did he rise to power in the Philippines?
He's originally not from Davao in the southern Philippines, but he came up and his family built a political dynasty in Davao, which is in the southern Philippines. So you can say he's from the southern Philippines. And he had been mayor for many years of Davao. His daughter is actually the mayor there now. And he developed a reputation as the mayor there of as kind of a tough guy, tough macho guy. Some would probably say, and have been said in many human rights reports, that tough macho approach towards crime and other issues often veered into extra-legal, extrajudicial means. He was known for his tough guy approach to drugs and crime, but there was also many reports of essentially extrajudicial killings and death squads, etc., when he was mayor of Davao. And in fact, when he was mayor, he was denied a visa to the United States, probably for reasons of concerns about human rights. The Philippines has a presidential system in which the president serves 1 6-year term only. So there's a presidential election every 6 years. And so in 2016, there was a presidential election. And being a president for 6 years is a long time, and in a way can give you a lot of power. It's a fairly long time, and you can, to some extent, you can look at it as you're immediately a lame duck. On the other hand, you can look at it as you don't have to run again, so you can do kind of whatever you want to some extent. So in the 2016 election, Duterte ran as among many other candidates. It's a first-past-the-post election with no runoff, so with many major candidates who run. So unlike in the U.S. where there's essentially usually the Democrat and the Republican, and there may be minor candidates, but it's very, very rare that a third-party candidate gets very many votes. In the Philippines, multiple candidates can get large numbers of votes. So you can win a presidential election with a much, much less than 50% of the vote. There's no second round runoff as there would be like in France, where they have a first round with lots of people who run, and then a second round, which ensures that the winner of France's presidential election automatically is elected by at least 50% plus one person. So Duterte ran on a sort of similar platform as he had been in as mayor, crackdown on crime, crackdown on drugs, war on drugs. And his campaign was imbued with a sort of macho pseudo-authoritarianism rhetoric, and also some of the same sort of aspects of sort of the idea of transgressive politics that characterizes a lot of the sort of illiberal leaders who have come to power today in recent years in other countries like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, or leaders of Hungary and Poland and Turkey, some would say Donald Trump, in which he would make wild, profane statements, and his supporters would engage in extremely misogynistic statements. And he sort of allowed his supporters, he gave them the freedom to kind of transgress, which seemed appealing to many, at least to some people. And he also sort of took on, although not as extreme as someone like Bolsonaro or Modi or someone, but sort of played into the idea that he alone could represent the true people of the country, and that the elites had failed them, and sort of by default, democracy had failed them. So he won the presidential election in part because there were so many candidates running, in part because he is charismatic and these things appealed, but also in part because there were so many candidates running, and a number of candidates who were more committed to liberal democracy didn't drop out of the race and back one person, and so Duterte won, and he became president in 2016.
Great. So you talked a little bit about his domestic policies. So I'm wondering if you could speak about his foreign policy agenda. When he was running for office in 2016, what were his main goals, and to what extent have they been successful since he took power?
Well, I was just talking about his agenda when he was mayor of Davao. That's not exactly, some of that is consistent with what he's done as president, although not all of it. And then remember that COVID came, and so thrown everything for a loop. But to the extent he had a real foreign policy agenda when he was running for president, it was mostly talking about how Duterte has a very, 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 the Philippines generally in polls, and if you ask people, there are very warm views on a person-to-person level and culturally of the United States. It was a U.S. colony, and there were some, it was a Spanish colony for a long time, and then it was a U.S. colony, and there were certainly some very serious atrocities committed by U.S. forces during the colonization of the Philippines. And yet at the same time, the Philippines historically tends to be one of the most pro-U.S. countries in the world. Duterte, who, however, has a very, very strong ingrained anti-Americanism, which dates back a long time, and I don't know if anyone knows for sure why that is. Certainly the denial of the visa didn't help. There was a strange situation when he was mayor of Davao, in which there was an explosion in a hotel in Davao, and he believes that the U.S. was somehow involved and that they spirited the person who committed the explosion out. Duterte has claimed that when he was young, he was assaulted by an American priest. When he was very young, there's no way to verify or not verify that statement. The person he claimed is deceased. He is imbued with a very deep sense of anti-Americanism, I would say. To the extent that his campaign had a foreign policy view, it was that the Philippines should reduce its reliance on the U.S. in all sorts of ways, strategically and other ways, and instead should build up a closer relationship with China, both strategically and also by building a close relationship with China. The Philippines would benefit because Chinese companies would invest tons of money in the Philippines and help build infrastructure with the Philippines genuinely and badly needs, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was much of the core of his foreign policy, unless you also include the Vatican, which is both, I guess, a religious and a foreign policy. The Philippines is mostly a Catholic country and has one of the largest numbers of Catholics in the world. Duterte is fairly antagonistic towards the Catholic Church. You can look it up. I'm not going to repeat it here, but he said some pretty profane things about Pope Francis. And so, he also, on the campaign trail and in office, has in some ways tried to move to reduce the Philippines' relationship with the Catholic Church, which is probably already happening. Some of the ways he has tried has been ways simply, which would be actually more progressive in terms of improving access to reproductive health. Other ways are simply just him just spouting off at the church. And in the past, the church in the Philippines has often been a bulwark for democracy, whatever it has been in other places. And the Philippines has often, going back decades, been a bulwark for democracy and human rights. So Duterte probably does not like that role of the church either. So sorry, that's kind of a long-winded answer.
No, not at all. So we briefly discussed, you know, Duterte's domestic objectives, both from his days as a mayor, during his campaign, and also his often perplexing foreign policy objectives and campaign promises and his anti-American leanings. Like we discussed in 2016, Duterte was elected with 39% of the vote, you know, first past the post, with a 13-point difference between himself and the next closest candidate.
Right, but you got to remember that in that there's two candidates below him who, who are basically liberal Democrats, and if you had combined them, mm-hmm. if one of them had pulled out, they probably would have beaten him.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. But I'm wondering, to what extent have the Filipino people supported Duterte's presidency? You know, has the support waned, waxed, and how has the popularity changed over time?
It is true that he won, and in part he won because of the divided opposition, but as president, Duterte has generally enjoyed enormously high popularity ratings that no U.S. politician would ever even possibly dream of. You know, at different times, like popularity ratings of, you know, 75% approval, above 75% approval. I don't follow it that closely, but there's quite a lot of polling in the Philippines, you know. Sometimes even higher than that, 80%, 85% approval ratings, you know. I mean, by comparison, like in the initial couple months after Joe Biden was elected, there was a brief honeymoon period, which is pretty typical in the U.S., where Biden's approval rating was favorable. It was above water. It's actually below water now. That I think that Biden's approval rating was something like 55% or something at his high point. I don't know. You can see on 538 and Real Clear Politics have a tracker. But no, Duterte's was just like 70s, 80s, and 90s. So he has enjoyed very, very strong popularity since president. And there's probably a number of reasons for that. Although his satisfaction has fallen with, in recent months, as he ends his term, and because he hasn't handled COVID very well, and there's probably some degree of fatigue and with him, etc. But he still has very high support, and there are probably a number of reasons for that. One, after Duterte became president, he embarked on this extrajudicial, overseeing this extrajudicial drug war, but that happened to be fairly popular, unfortunately, with some significant amount of Filipinos. Second, after becoming president, Duterte also sort of became just his central figure in everything and dominating, you know, public life. And I think that also probably leads to his popularity. Third, he spent much of the last 6 years, you know, undermining and crushing opposition, attacking the press, undermining the independence of the Supreme Court, overseeing putting opposition politicians in jail, et cetera, et cetera. And so there may be some percentage of people who are simply scared to tell anyone that they don't support him. And some of his policies beyond the drug war are popular. I mean, Duterte is a weird mix. He's not, a lot of these sort of illiberal leaders in the current era are sort of more from the right, like Bolsonaro or Modi or Viktor Orban in Hungary or Trump or leaders of Poland, but they're not all. I mean, you could throw in like Nicolas Maduro, or the president of Mexico, although he's not quite as extreme, but Duterte has also passed some other policies that are popular. You know, I mean, he has tried to show that he cares about the poor, and he has passed some policies designed to sort of bolster the poor, and some policies that would be generally progressive. But overall, I think much of that popularity is simply due to the Duterte just dominates public life now. Until recently, and the support has waned a little bit, probably because he's not leaving the scene. He's planning to run for a Senate to be a senator, but he's sort of leaving the scene, and also because he's handled COVID poorly, and the Philippines has been wrecked by COVID, both wrecked mm-hmm. public health wise and wrecked economically.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about, you know, beyond, you know, the omnipresence perhaps of, you know, Duterte in Philippine society now, you talked a bit about, you know, how there is, you know, huge domestic support, perhaps surprisingly, for many of his domestic policies. But I wanted to ask about his foreign policy, and, you know, we described it as anti-American. So is there a broad anti-American sentiment among Filipinos, or is the support for Duterte somewhat detached from his foreign policy objectives?
Yeah, I think it's pretty detached from his foreign policy objectives. I mean, there's certainly a complex relationship between the United States and the Philippines historically, going back to the fact that it was a colony and there were atrocities committed during that period. And yet at the same time, the United States and the Philippines have very close cultural links. And the United States did play a central role in defending the Philippines, along with Filipinos, defending the Philippines in the Second World War, and then independence was granted. I think Duterte's China policy is his policy. I think there are plenty of Filipinos who would be happy if there was more Chinese investment, if that led to, you know, greater economic growth and better. But the fact of the matter is Duterte's sort of attempt to swing to China, and it has been mitigated anyway. I mean, Duterte has the Philippines is still a U.S. treaty ally, and it's not like the relationship has been severed. But for all of Duterte's kind of wooing of China, there really hasn't been a lot of big Chinese mega projects that were set up, a lot of big investment, et cetera. So he hasn't really gotten that. And I don't think that his own personal, desire to sort of move the strategic relationship enjoys much support among the Filipino population. But that's kind of divorced from his domestic policy.
So I want to pick up on something that you referenced a bit earlier, which is, so on October 2nd, Duterte announced that he was going to run for vice president, and then he announced his retirement from politics. And then, as you said, he just announced in mid-November his decision to run for Senate. So how can we explain this kind of flip-flopping behavior, and how did Filipinos react to his various decisions?
Well, I don't think the idea of him running for vice president seemed very popular That's why he didn't do it. And I don't, his running for Senate is probably another reason why, and his popularity, his rating has gone down because people, there's some fatigue and people probably wanted him to exit the scene. He's probably running for Senate because as a senator, it offers him essentially impunity from any investigations into any wrongdoings he oversaw as president. That would be my guess as to why he wants to be a senator, as well as to just sort of continue to meddle in politics. But the first point would be it would just sort of guarantee him essentially impunity from any investigations or much investigations into what happened when he was president. Several of the last Philippine presidents have, Joseph Estrada and Gloria Macapagal-Arroyo, both wound up in jail for various crimes, really, corruption and other related crimes. So two of the last three Philippine presidents. And the situation is even more complex now because his daughter is running for vice president on a ticket with the son of Ferdinand Marcos, the former dictator. But Duterte is endorsing someone else, a longtime aide of his, to run for president against his daughter's ticket. So it's going to be pretty chaotic. There'll be other quite well-known people running. Manny Pacquiao, the famous, globally famous boxer, and who's also a Philippine senator, is running for president. And the current vice president, in the Philippines, the vice president and the president are not necessarily running mates. So the current vice president is actually an opponent of Duterte. The current vice president, Lenny Robredo, is running for president. So it's going to be another thing in which there will be a lot of people running, and no one's going to get, 50% of the vote. But the probably more important point about the upcoming election in 2022 is it will be an interesting test of whether the Philippines is going to permanently backslide into kind of illiberal democracy, if not outright authoritarianism, or not. Marcos Jr. and Duterte's daughter would probably continue Duterte's evisceration of Philippine democracy. It's also possible that Duterte's preferred presidential candidate would do the same. And it's also possible that Manny Pacquiao, although it's kind of unclear what Manny Pacquiao's political beliefs are, he has some authoritarian-esque beliefs. So you have multiple candidates running who could perpetuate six more years of a democratic backsliding. There are other candidates, like the current vice president, who are presenting themselves as liberal Democrats and presenting the election as one of democracy versus a return to outright authoritarianism. And I think you will see a lot of that portrayal of this election, both by the candidates who are sort of more liberal Democrats, and also the way it's covered at least in the foreign press and probably to some extent in the Philippine press.
So we wanted to discuss just a bit more about the upcoming presidential election. It's scheduled to be held in early May. So we discussed, some major candidates running. You mentioned that, President Duterte's daughter, Sara Duterte, has endorsed and joining Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s ticket for the vice presidency. So I'm wondering kind of what are some of the key issues at stake during this election, starting with domestic policy? Are people seeking a break from policies under Duterte, especially the war on drugs? How will that affect kind of the democratic backsliding that you were discussing just a moment ago?
I doubt that policies are going to be at the center of the Philippine presidential election. In the Duterte election when he won, yes, he talked about the drug war, etc., but it was more about him creating an aura around himself. Policy is not really probably going to be at the forefront, other than that there will be some discussion, especially from the liberal democratic camp, of this is the election to save democracy in the Philippines. But I don't think, you know, I mean, I think policy is rarely at the forefront of Philippine presidential elections. There will be a lot of, there will be a lot of focusing on the individuals and covering it as, I mean, Manny Pacquiao is a famous boxer and you have the son of a dictator, and there will, I mean, there are major issues. The economy is in terrible shape. In a country that was already, you know, very, very unequal and had severe problems with hunger. Output hasn't even returned anywhere to near pre-COVID levels. They have really serious problems with vaccine hesitancy. They have very low vaccination rates. They've had really, really serious problems with controlling infections. There are a lot of real issues. I mean, the economy had grown quite well, actually, under Duterte's predecessor and then under Duterte until the pandemic. They have huge debt problems. They have, people might be thinking about the candidates. I'm sure will talk about how they plan to approach COVID and get more people vaccinated and boost the economy, which is in terrible shape, and try to get money to spend on infrastructure and address poverty. I'm simply saying that I doubt most of the discussion of the campaign will revolve around those policy issues. Instead, probably as in prior elections and certainly as in 2016, and even more so because you got Duterte's daughter and Ferdinand Marcos Jr., plus Duterte's anointed successor, plus Manny Pacquiao, a world-famous figure, all in the election already. Most of the discussion is just going to be about the candidates' personalities. I should also mention that another major factor is the Philippines has one of the highest penetrations of social media of any developing country in the world, and it is one of the worst problems with social media disinformation of any country in the world, maybe the worst.
I guess we touched a bit on, you know, domestic policy and how, you know, each individual candidate's personalities are, you know, perhaps going to outweigh the importance of, you know, different domestic issues and, you know, the ongoing COVID crisis and vaccine hesitancy and all these domestic issues. But I'm also wondering about, you know, the foreign policy tendencies of some of these major candidates, like, you know, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., Manny Pacquiao. You said, you know, his political, you know, ideology and, you know, priorities are perhaps unclear at this time. But, you know, do you envision that, you know, whoever gets elected, Philippines, you know, gravitation towards Beijing will continue? Or was Duterte's foreign policy more of an aberration that was a product of his personal idiosyncrasies and personal tendencies?
Duterte's daughter is less enamored with this idea of China, of becoming closer to China. And Duterte has already spent 6 years trying this and getting very little from it. So I don't think there's going to be any of the candidates are going to be, you know, as aggressively talking about the Philippines needs to move closer to China away from the U.S. because it didn't really work for 6 years. Sara Duterte, who I understand is just a vice presidential candidate, but is not as, you know, doesn't have as warm views of China as her father. Marcos Jr. has pretty close relations with China. So, I mean, I guess you could see that potentially some continuation. I mean, every country in Southeast Asia has to deal with the fact that China is the most important economic actor in Southeast Asia, the dominant economic actor. So any Philippine president, any president of any leader of any country in Southeast Asia has to reckon with that. And so they're every country in Southeast Asia to some extent or another is dealing with that reality. Some of them are also dealing with the reality, like the Philippines and Vietnam, that China is also pursuing a very aggressive strategic policy, which is depriving them of, or potentially depriving them of, their territorial rights in the South China Sea and other problems as well. But whoever is elected is going to have to deal with China, and that includes managing China as the regional economic giant. It's possible that Ferdinand Marcos Jr. might be a little closer to China than some of the other candidates. It's also possible that Duterte's anointed successor, Bongo, might be a little closer. Whereas Leni Robredo probably would be, both because she wants to be opposed to essentially whatever Duterte stands for, and also because she views herself as a liberal Democrat and China's authoritarian state, maybe a little bit less sympathetic. But Manny Pacquiao, I couldn't tell you. I mean, Manny Pacquiao has had some policy positions. I mean, when Duterte was at the height of the extrajudicial killings of the drug war, Manny Pacquiao was very much in favor of that, and then he broke from that. But in terms of Manny Pacquiao's foreign policy views about China or regional strategy, et cetera, I really couldn't tell you. I have no idea. I'm not even sure that. If he's enunciated them, I haven't heard much about them, and I would suspect that Manny Pacquiao is not going to be running for president based on his foreign policy views. That's not going to be central to his campaign. His campaign will be, I'm Manny Pacquiao. I think Manny Pacquiao has, at times, slammed Duterte for not being standing up to China over the South China Sea. So he has said some things like that, but in terms of whether Manny Pacquiao is going to run his presidential campaign with foreign policy issues as at the center, I very much doubt it. I think the campaign will be on Manny Pacquiao, and he may criticize Duterte's China policy because he has in the past, but I'm Manny Pacquiao, and here's my incredible life story, which is truly, many aspects of it aren't truly incredible. And, I'm honest. I don't know if that's true, but no reason not to believe that. It's sort of a similar story in some ways to some other former Philippine presidents, who sort of, there was an entertainer, Joseph Estrada, et cetera. So anyway, the long and short, Manny Pacquiao was probably more hawkish on China than Duterte or Marcos Jr. He has repeatedly criticized Duterte about being too soft on China, but I doubt foreign policy issues would be at the center of Manny Pacquiao's campaign, and I doubt they would be at the center of the campaign period. The campaign will be about personalities. I continue, no, mm-hmm. Exactly.
But I'm wondering, what perhaps the United States can do to, while as Philippines recognizes that China will continue to be, the dominant force in that region, what the United States can do.
Dominant economic force.
Uh-huh. Right. But what the United States can do to perhaps, shift the alignment of these countries closer to the United States and recognize, or not recognize, but, perhaps stray away from, perhaps over-relying on Chinese dominant economic posture.
China is the dominant economic actor for a number of reasons. One, they're closer to China. B, China is the biggest trading partner of all of these countries, as it is with many, many countries all around the world. I'm not sure the United States is really in a position to alter that trajectory too much. And at the same time, many of these countries have poor views of China's strategically, and are actually incensed the way that China's acted over the last year, with China's increasingly assertive diplomacy. But in terms of, if you're asking whether the United States can do anything about China being, if not dominant, the most powerful economic actor in the region, and the United States should have, in my opinion, pursued a region-wide trade deal We're past a region-wide trade deal 5 years ago called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have given the United States a greater stake in regional economic integration, which doesn't only involve China, but that regional economic integration involves China with the countries of Southeast Asia, it involves Japan with the countries of Southeast Asia, it involves China and Japan, it involves India with Southeast Asia, it involves a whole range of economic integration. But the United States did not pass that agreement, and since then has offered no real clear, coherent economic or trade strategy for the region. The Biden administration is supposedly working on a Indo-Pacific strategy and one that may include aspects of that, but without any sort of real trade policy, it's hard to have one. And so while the U.S. has had no trade policy, East Asia, Southeast and Northeast Asia have increasingly integrated economically, and China has become more and more central to that integration.
Great. So I'm just going to wrap us up here with our final question, which is, we like to take kind of a future-looking stance to end our podcast. So I guess, to what extent is this upcoming election in the Philippines important? What is at stake? And what should our listeners be looking out for in terms of Filipino politics or regional dynamics?
I definitely think it's important. I mean, I would agree with probably what Lenny Robredo and some others like her are going to say, which is that this may be an election which is indeed a turning point of democracy versus the Philippines more permanently sliding into illiberal democracy or outright authoritarianism. The Philippines is a little unique because there's just, you know, you're president once for 6 years and you can't run again. But some of the candidates, like Marcos and Duterte and Bongo, who's actually Rodrigo Duterte's preferred successor, are kind of running as six more years of policies that might be similar to in some ways to Duterteism. Polarization, undermining institutions, attacking the press, etc. Usually, when there is a democratic backsliding, the first election after an illiberal figure comes to power is the best time to stop that backsliding, usually, because illiberalism has not become so entrenched, and it is easier to stop. So for example, like in Hungary, Viktor Orban initially was a kind of a Democrat, and as time went on, the first election would have been the best time to stop him. And time went on, he became more and more and more authoritarian, similar with Erdogan. So although Duterte is not running again, Duterteism is kind of running again. And so I think if Duterteism has another 6 years, you will probably see the Philippines slide backward into something it's already become much more repressive than it was 6 years ago, and it will turn into something even more repressive, including perhaps outright authoritarianism. So that's a really serious thing. I mean, the Philippines has been since the mid-80s, you know, with caveats of a successful democracy with a very strong civil society and a very, very vibrant press. So for it to revert to more illiberal situation or outright authoritarianism would be a real shame. So I think that's the biggest reason why this election matters. I mean, the more times, the longer an illiberal leader or types of leaders are in power, the harder it is to dislodge them. So, you know, you could go through a series of other examples too, but like when Putin first won, the election wasn't completely free and fair, but it was somewhat free and fair. And then over time, Putin amassed more and more and more and more control. Things became less and less and less and less. And now Russia is an outright dictatorship.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Anytime.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.